sure you are in fellowship here and continue on dealing with these demons that are going to be busily engaged in deceiving the kings of the earth through the miraculous signs which it will be given them to do, and that will convince these kings, apparently, that their success, their endeavor will be successful, and that they will move to war with some sign that it is going to work out to their advantage. And we are dealing here with the last one we looked at, point 22, that there are a lot of people, well, actually 21, many cultures around the world, ancient and modern, have believed in signs and omens as a source of valuable information about what life holds. And therefore, 22, while Satan and his unseen minions will be openly attempting to deceive the world into following his plan, one must recognize that the world has been largely prepared for these events over the years. This mystical, what we would call New Age religion, is mystical, all right, but it is not new. It has been around for a long time and is basically a syncretism, a blend of various things and streams of thought that have coalesced into some sort of a unified whole, although what each person believes that's in all this, who knows. Well, 23, the United Nations has steadily become a center of syncretic, that means a blend, of New World religion, a weird and diabolical convergence of New Age mysticism, pantheism, that means that God is everything. So pantheism is that all things are God, therefore you better not kick a rock because you have kicked God. And you better not pick a plant because you've wrecked God. God is that plant, and so you've uprooted God. Well, that's the stupidity that these people fall into. Aboriginal animism, which comes from the Aborigine tribes, atheism, communism, socialism, Luciferian occultism, apostate Christianity, and they're very much involved in this. That's the whole thing. These apostate Christian leaders are steadily becoming increasingly involved with these fringe groups, these wrong groups, these evil groups like Islam and Taoism and Buddhism, and they invite them to pray with them and various other things that they do in the name of their enlightened view towards the world and how they see things. Well, this is the way it's been going. 24, the devotees and apostles of this new faith include a strange admixture of crystal worshipers, astrologers, feminists, environmentalists, Kabbalists, human potentialists, Eastern mystics, pop psychologists, and liberal clergymen. The human potentialists are like the guy out there that has the Crystal Cathedral, Robert, what's his name? It escapes me at the moment, but he just says, you know, just think it, and if you can think it, you can do it. And again, the Kabbalah has gotten a lot of play recently because of Madonna and various celebrities that engage in this, quote, faith. Well, 25, however, today's worshipers in this rapidly expanding environment are just as likely to be scientists, diplomats, corporate presidents, heads of states, international bankers, and leaders of mainstream Christian churches. 26, many of their doctrines are published by the Lucius Trust. Now, that's an interesting little group. The Lucius Trust was established by Alison Foster Bailey in 1922. Which continues to serve as an umbrella organization for a profusion of globalist New Age occult organizations and programs. And you can see the link there. If you do type that in, it is case sensitive, so you're going to have to capitalize where it's capitalized and all of that. So CrossPod is just actually a place that hosts Christian websites. Much of this information is out of an article from the New American, if you're familiar with that magazine. It's kind of a conservative sort of right-wing Christian view of things, and they have some interesting insights and all of that. I mean, I don't have time to read it and keep up with it, so I don't have a subscription to it, but for those who like a different slant on the news than what you read and see on TV and all that, they provide, and as usual, these types of things out there, you have to take everything with a grain of salt. You cannot get up and say, well, Ron wants us to subscribe to the New American. No, I don't. That's entirely up to you. If you want to read it, that's your choice. I would probably get some samples and read it and see if you like it, if it's something you want to follow. There are some good articles that come out of it. And this one one of the major writers is William Jasper, and a lot of this information comes from there. So basically, if you're familiar with any of the evil out there throughout the ages that has existed in the world, Helena Blavatsky was the founder of what is known as the Theosophical Movement. And this is basically another anti-Christian organization that masquerades in the name of religion. And she is, in effect, what they would say, she was the high priest of the New Age movement, the modern New Age movement. She lived back in the 1800s. And towards the end of the 1800s. But she taught this sort of hidden wisdom that you could have if you just got hooked up with the right people, and that the truth was out there. I mean, she's kind of like those guys on the X-Files. The truth is out there. We just got to know where to find it and all that. So the problem was she didn't really like the monotheistic religions, the religions that believe in one God. And certainly Christianity, you know, among others, falls into that. So that's part of her enlightenment. She couldn't reconcile, you know, the historic faith of Christianity. So therefore, it went by the wayside. Well, some of her thoughts are, she made the Theosophical Society posted their statement of what their agenda was, and it says, to oppose every form of dogmatic theology, especially the Christian, with the chiefs of society, which the chiefs of society regard as particularly pernicious. We're viewed as a very, very, very dangerous enemy to these people. To counteract as far as possible the effects of missionaries, to delude the so-called heathen and pagan as to the real origin and dogmas of Christianity, and the practical effects of the latter upon public and private character. Esoteric philosophy has never rejected God in nature, nor deity as the absolute and abstract end. It only refuses to accept any of the gods of the so-called monotheistic religions, gods created by man in his own image and likeness, a blasphemous and sorry caricature of the ever unknowable. So in effect, basically, she would say, we're worshiping the wrong God. We're worshiping a God of our own invention. And that people that fall into this kind of stuff are obviously dupes. She looks at us as just being completely stupid. And so she, you know, she basically was, we might say, the ringleader, the founding father of all of this. And some of her biblical hermeneutics go as follows. Once the key to Genesis is in our hands, the scientific and symbolical Kabbalah, again, unveils the secret. The great serpent of the Garden of Eden and the Lord God are identical. Well, that's an interesting concept. Huh, they seem antithetical in my Bible, but in her thinking, they're the same. Why? Because Lucifer is God. That's their doctrine. So she explains Satan as God, the Creator, the Savior, the Father, and Jesus Christ is the firstborn brother of Satan. That's not too blasphemous, but whatever. Satan, the serpent of Genesis, is the real creator and benefactor, the spiritual father of mankind. For it is he who opened the eyes of the automaton. That was Adam. See, Adam didn't know anything. He was just a stupid little zombie there in the garden, and Satan woke him up. Well, that was neat. As he was created by Jehovah, as alleged, an adversary to Jehovah. This woman practiced what we call astral projection, if you're familiar with that, and had the ability to transport herself, as she said, in and out and around the spirit world. And she claimed to have written the document. If you're familiar with this, you may not be. But again, some of these names you can research if you have time to or desire to, called Isis Unveiled. Isis, of course, is the mother in the mystery mother-son cult out of Egypt. And she wrote a three-volume opus, The Secret Doctrine, under the direction of the Masters of Wisdom, Tibetan holy men who communicated telepathically with her in England from the Himalayas. That's kind of cool. I'm going to write me a book, too. I'm getting communication from Tony Dungy. Well, after she died, and she died in about 1890 or so, 1891, I think. And after she died, the mantle went over to Annie Besant. And again, if you do any research at all into the occult, you will run across these names. Trust me. And these are ringleaders in the occult Luciferian movement. And so then we end up now with our people here. The Baileys are like the third generation of this, and they founded the Lucius Trust, but they, and the irony is, when they launched this thing, the Lucius Trust was going to be a publishing company, and the name of it was Lucifer Publishing. But they came to realize that maybe the world wasn't really quite ready for everybody to come out and say exactly what they thought, that Lucifer was God. And so they shortened it to Lucius. And that's it's just obviously the first part of Lucifer. But they recognized that this would keep them out of trouble at some level. So this trust established by the Baileys is an umbrella for all kinds of stuff, of evil, of organizations. They have the Arcane School, the World Goodwill. That's not to be confused with the goodwill that goes around doing good. Lucius Publishing, Lucius Productions, Lucius Trust, and a neat one called the New Group of World Servers. See, these masters of wisdom who have transcended time and space are here to lead the world into a new age of enlightenment and into a new doctrine under Lucifer in which all that oppose all this are going to be taken out. Well, again, you can read about them. You can read that article. That's an article out of, the link there. A, these wealthy and powerful people have taught humanity is not following a haphazard or uncharted course and state. Men of goodwill, i.e. not us, who cooperate form part of the new group of world servers, which is working to implement the plan. Anytime you read the plan, read the lie, because that's what it is. This is the lie. This is the doctrines of the lie exposed. At least the doctrines as they pertain to us in our period of history. B, the plan involves a spiritual hierarchy. These are quotes from them. I'm not making this up. These are their own quotes. That's why I have them like this. Involves a spiritual hierarchy of the planet and the building of a synthetic unity. A synthetic unity? Wait a minute, isn't that a false unity? Synthetic means not real, doesn't it? A synthetic unity that will be manifested in the inner center of subjective world government, whose members are responsible for the spread of these ideals and the ideas which have led humanity onwards from age to age. And again, you get into the concept of the paradigm shift and the fact that they're anticipating a new age to come very shortly, that we are going to be entering into a new realm of consciousness. And the ideas that these people espouse are so ludicrous that a thinking person would look at them and say, you've got to be nuts. But the reality is, number one, the world's always inevitably dissatisfied with a lot of things. You can find all kinds of things to be dissatisfied about. And so they're always looking for something. But unfortunately, like you too, they still haven't found what they're looking for. But the reality is, they continually think that there's just, the glorious future's just around the corner. That's all we got to do is figure it out. Well, see, they believe in a fourfold division of humanity, behind which stand those enlightened ones, whose right and privilege it is to watch over human evolution and to guide the destinies of men. In the West, we call them Christ and his disciples. See, now, when they talk about Christ and his disciples, they're not talking about the same guys we are. This is just their terminology for it. And they use terminology they know that's acceptable to Christians because Christians will then be swept along with it and say, well, they believe the same thing we believe. They believe in the same... No, they don't. That's the thing. And this is where vocabulary becomes and can be very dissimulating in some ways. People can use the right vocabulary to mask an evil agenda. And that's where you really have to be careful. Because when they're talking the same language you're talking, you're thinking, well, we're on the same wavelength. And some of my biggest mistakes in life were ever believing that I was on the same wavelength with certain people. Because we discussed the same things. We had what I thought was the same agenda, which was to grow up spiritually and complete our course and function under a local church and do our thing under God's will and all that. Well, they had other agendas that I was unaware of. So again, but they use the same vocabulary, so it's easy to be snowed sometimes. So in the West, we call them Christ and his disciples. They are also known as the agents of God or the hierarchy of liberated souls who seek ceaselessly to aid and help humanity. That's a nice thing, though, that they're helping us. In what way are they helping us? They're leading us to destruction. Well, the work leaders of the new group of world servers provide the vision, mold public opinion, and no doubt will work in concert with the satanic demonic forces behind the scenes. App at the head of the several of the governments of the world and in the great world agencies like the United Nations agencies, there will either be a master or at least a third degree initiate. Obviously, they have, again, divided this into four categories of people, and depending on how much you're into the evil, how much you want to rise in the organization, you can get as high as you want, I guess. Just like, you know, some of these other organizations. So, gee, therefore, the great international agencies will be under the direct control of a high member of the hierarchy. The Christ himself will have a great deal to do with the release of energies, the work of initiation, as the initiator, the hierophant, at the first two initiations, and the stimulating and inspiring the formation of the new world religion. There can be little doubt that the modern pagan religions will play a large part in the success of these demons, who will no doubt present themselves as a Christ. This is why, isagogically, when you look at what Jesus was saying to the disciples in Matthew 24, when he said, if anyone says to you, here is the Christ, he is here, he's in the inner rooms, he's there, and it appears like he's getting at that they're going to be saying Christ is everywhere, pretty much. And that plays right into what these people are promoting. And again, while they don't know how this is all going to turn out, the reality is this is their will to do these things. They fully believe that Lucifer is God and that he's gotten a bad rap, and they're sorry for him, but they're going to make it all right. And they're going to eliminate all those idiots like us who suggest that Lucifer is not God and that he did not get a bad rap, that he sinned willingly and will bear his eternal punishment for that. So these people, again, as we point out, while these demons are actively involved behind the scenes, the fact is humanity's all ready for this. They welcome this kind of stuff. 27, there is no doubt that Satan is attempting to destroy the Jews at this point, and his tactic appears to be to overwhelm the remnant with massive numbers of invading forces, which they will not be able to withstand. 28, while Satan has his own agenda, which he will be pursuing vigorously, he is unwittingly working to fulfill the greater purpose of God to assemble the nations of the world for their destruction, as per Isaiah 34. And so all of this has been prophesied before, so we can look at the Bible and say, you know what, God knew all about all this. There isn't anything these evil idiots out there are doing that, number one, God wasn't aware of, and number two, that he doesn't have under control. So one thing is, number one, when you hear all this stuff, and it can be a little overwhelming, I recognize, the extent and the nature of evil and how rampant it is out there can be a little overwhelming. But don't let it bother you. Don't let it worry you. Look at it and say, well, guess what? The overwhelming evil's out there, but God's going to protect me. He's going to take care of me in spite of what anybody else does. That God loves me personally. I may not be very lovable, but God's dumb and he loves me anyway. And he's going to take care of me, and so I don't have to worry about any of this at a certain level. Other than, as an intelligent believer, you should be aware of what's going on. It doesn't serve to just put your head in the ground and say, well, I don't need to know any of this. You need to be aware that it's out there, because you're going to run across it in various forms. And when you start seeing some of these names or seeing some of these evil concepts, I mean, they're incorporating this slowly into the curriculum in the schools, obviously. You'll see certain terminology in the textbooks that didn't used to be there. You'll see revisionist history as you read the textbooks. If you go back, if I could do it, and I can't, but if I could go get an 8th or 9th or 10th grade textbook from what we studied, and of course this was in the late 60s, and you know, and bring it out now, and you read it 35 years later, you say, my textbook's nothing like that. Absolutely not. History's being rewritten as we go. And they put their own little spin on it, and you know, there you go. So this evil is out there, again, be aware of it, but it is the source of prophecy and subject to prophecy. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, and his wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. So their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood. And all the host of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll. And their host will wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, as one withers from the fig tree. For my sword is satiated in heaven. Behold, it will descend for judgment upon Edom, upon the people whom I have delivered for destruction. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat and the blood of lambs and goats and with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. A wild oxen shall also fall among them and young bulls with strong ones. Thus their land will be soaked with blood and their dust become greasy with fat. By the way, this is, in my opinion, refers to prophetic Edom, and this particular passage focuses specifically on the U.S. The prophetic Edom as seen under, say, Jeremiah here and also in Obadiah, and a careful reading of the passages in Jeremiah and other places, Isaiah and Jeremiah. You read certain passages about prophetic political Babylon, and the very same words are used of prophetic Edom. Now, why go under two code names? Well, as we pointed out earlier, Babylon and Edom very well describe the U.S. as a code. One, it is the land of confusion. That's what Babylon means. And number two, as Esau, we are the only nation that's traded away our birthright for a mess of queers. That's all we got. We got a mess of feminist queers and environmentalists for our trade. We traded away our Christian heritage, and now we've got a bunch of evil people and a bunch of evil idiots out there in power, and look what we've got. Well, we are like Esau in that regard. That's the nation. We were founded upon the proper principles, and slowly but surely those were eroded until now it's non-existent. This is not the nation that our forefathers envisioned, trust me. Our forefathers have, if you could have talked to them about a government that's trillions of dollars in debt and raising that ceiling. Hey, by the way, this would be nice, wouldn't it? Let's do our budget today. Okay, I can see, you know, I'm spending more money than I'm making. But I think I should have the right to have debt that I don't have to account for. So I'm going to raise my debt ceiling. And I can keep spending then, and as I get closer to the debt ceiling, you know what I'll do? I'll raise it again. And I'll keep spending and keep saying, send me credit cards. And I'll keep spending and spending and spending until I raise the debt ceiling. And then every time I get close to the debt ceiling, I'll raise it so that I never go through it. That's what our government does. Now, does that sound like sound fiscal policy? They would lock us up if we lived that way. These people are criminals. And the banks are just as bad as the government themselves. The whole concept. I like the way the banks do loans. They fabricate money out of nothing, loan it to you, and charge you interest on money that doesn't even exist. That's a pretty neat principle. Now, how can I sign up for that one? I'll write you a loan on money I don't have. I'll just give you somebody else's money, and then I'll charge you interest on it. Well, that's kind of a nice racket. Well, this is the nature of the world in which we live. And all of this is, if our founding, they'd be turning over in their graves if they knew what was going on in the name of what America has become. Also, Joel chapter 3, verse 2. And I will bring all the nations, I will gather all the nations, and I will bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, what we're not told here, but what we're told in Revelation, is that the technique by which he's going to gather the nations is going to be through these demons. He's going to employ them, letting them do their thing without violating their volition, and just use them to do that. And then I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my inheritance Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations. And they have divided up my land. Micah 4:12 also. So, again, all these things, the evil that's out there, the way they're doing it, their agendas, and all of that, it's working right towards the fulfillment of God's plan that was prophesied from years back. Micah 4:12, but they do not know the thoughts of the Lord, and they do not understand his purpose. For he has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, daughter of Zion. For your horn I will make iron, and your hoofs I will make bronze, that you may pulverize many peoples, that you may devote to the Lord their unjust gain and their wealth to the Lord of all the earth. Of course, as we pointed out repeatedly, the last days are a really bad time to be laying up wealth. I mean, they're absolutely going to lose all of it. And Zechariah 14:2. So, as it says in James, going to rust. Their gold and silver is going to rust. burn their flesh like fire and be a witness against them. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half the city exiled. But the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Not going to be a complete destruction like it was, say, in 70 A.D. 29, since it is God's purpose to deal with the nations in judgment in the land of Palestine, he will use these three evil characters to gather the sacrifice to Israel. 30, that is the enforce of the finitive sunago, gather or collect, which should be classified here as one of purpose. While the New American Standard, point 31, translates the preposition ice as four, it is somewhat stronger in the Greek and means gather them right into the battle. Again, the difference between, we might say, watching a game or getting prepared for a game and the actual playing of it. When you're in the game, it's different. That's the difference between pros and ice in this context. They could be gathered to the battle, i.e. that might imply they were nothing more than spectators. They're going to be gathered right into the fighting. That's the force of it. 32, one should remember that Armageddon is not so much one single specific battle as it is a campaign. Now, the term focuses on the final aspect of the final battle. We recognize that. Which begins with the destruction of the U.S. and continues with persistent warfare throughout the last half of Daniel's 70th week. 33, Walford points out that the evidence seems to point to the conclusion that this is a climax of a series of military events described in Daniel 11, 40 through 45. Where the reference in verse 44 may have this Oriental invasion in view. And as we pointed out when we did the book of Daniel there, that yes, there's going to be a lot of military action going on. 40, at the end time, the king of the south will collide with him being Antichrist in this context, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. In other words, you're not going to stop this invading force. He will also enter the beautiful land. And many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand. Again, as we pointed out there in Edom and Petra, they're delivered for some reason. We're not told why, we're just told they are. Edom and Moab and the foremost of the sons of Ammon, again, which represents substantially, not exclusively, but modern-day Jordan. So if you look at a map and you see modern-day Jordan, you can pencil in Edom, Moab, and Ammon. That's where these people were. Then he will stretch out his hands against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. But rumors from the east. I wonder what the rumors are. Well, Walford had this one right. The rumors from the east is that the Chi-Com are mobilizing, and rumors from the north, Russia is retooling. They're back in it. And again, I don't know if I sent out that deal. Did I send you guys the article on the new missiles they've got? Okay, good. Then they're ready. They're tooling up. The bear is apparently coming out of hibernation, as we saw, you know, the lopsided bear there in Daniel 7. Arise, devour much flesh. Apparently the bear had not been eating and given. Again, the isagogics of that passage to me were fascinating. A hibernating bear doesn't eat for a long, long time. Russia hasn't committed, you know, what we would, really since the early 90s when they invaded Afghanistan, hasn't committed any real military aggression. I mean, other than against their own republics, but they're not out engaging in military aggression in the world, we might say. So the bear gets aroused. He's hungry. He's been asleep for a long time. He's been living off his fat. And then he wakes up, and he's lost a lot of body weight. So the bear, when he comes out, is a much leaner and a completely different animal than he was when he went into hibernation. So again, here, as Walbert is correct, that the rumors from the east and the north are going to destroy him, and disturb him. And he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. And he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. Ultimately, he's going to face Jesus Christ in open combat. He's going to lose. Well, 34, some have objected to this since they have wrongly concluded that all the nations of the earth will be united under the common banner during Daniel's 70th week. And this is a misunderstanding of the kingdom of Antichrist. That it's, while it's big, We're not arguing that it's not going to be large. If it covers all of Europe and even into the Mideast, into Asia Minor, and into the Balkans, say, into that region, that's a fairly extensive empire. But that doesn't mean that he controls the Chinese or the Russians or all these other formidable people that are still around. So, again, will some of the people in those countries have taken the mark and all of that? I would expect they would have, again, simply because of economic realities. Because the import-export business, as you should know, is global. It's worldwide. It's not just, you know, local. Well, 35, however, while these nations may have been forced into compliance with the economic policies established by the false prophet, it does not mean they are loyal to the Antichrist. And 36, because of this faulty understanding, some have suggested that all the armies, all loyal to the beast, are gathered in anticipation of the second advent and are simply there to make war against him and the heavenly armies. And that's not the correct read on it, in my opinion. Now, that's what they will ultimately do once they all get there, and they're going to be engaged in fighting each other, though, first and foremost. Then, at the second advent, when they see the Lord returning, then they all turn on him, because they recognize, if we can take him out, then we can settle this amongst ourselves. But, unfortunately, they lack the power. 37, the better explanation, which has been preferred by Wolford, is that it reflects a conflict among the nations themselves as the fragile world empire of the beast begins to deteriorate, and others strive to gain more control. One of the things that you see there in the Daniel passage is that, and we've seen it, again, I tried to deal with it and hopefully communicate it well, that Antichrist has got his plate full. He is a busy, busy guy. He's got a lot of things going on he's got to deal with. I mean, it's not only one thing to have to run your own empire, but to keep other empires at bay and then to have conflict and conquest where necessary and all of that. And clearly, he's got dreams of global domination. So he's not going to sit idly by and just wait for everybody to join him. He's going to be busy, busy, busy. And he's got a lot on his plate. He's got conflicts, as we saw, that he's going to sweep down across northern Africa, through Libya, through Egypt, even into the eastern portions there of Africa, up through the Negev and into Israel. And so, but again, this is all just a part of his military aspects. There's, you know, other things going on as well on the economic fronts and all of that. But they're gathered together. The fact is that they recognize, I would assume at some point, and I think this is what mobilizes the kings of the East, they recognize the Antichrist has dreams of global domination, and they're just not going to let that happen. That's their big reason for moving, in my opinion. And I agree with Wolford on this one, that is what motivates them to get involved in all this. It's not that they're actively fighting Jesus at this point. They will at some point, but that's not the real reason they're there. The real reason they're there is to claim their piece of the pie. Or to claim the whole pie, more likely. So 38, however, the result is the same. The armies of the world will descend on the Middle East and will end up facing Jesus Christ in open combat. They may not realize that, but that's what's going to happen. 39, the fact that the term war is articular has caused some to recognize that this is the end of the world battle, that this end of the world battle was predicted in the Old Testament and was attested in other Jewish literature. Joel 3:2, actually the passage we just looked at, but the rest of that chapter as well, in 9-17, proclaim this among the nations. Prepare a war. Rouse the mighty men. Let all the soldiers draw near. Let them come up. Beat your swords into beat your plowshares into swords, rather, and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am a mighty man. Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. Bring down, O Lord, your mighty ones. Let the nations be aroused and come to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe, as we saw this analogy expanded upon there in Revelation in the winepress. Come, tread, for the winepress is full, the harvest of the grapes, representing the negative volition of the masses at the end. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness. And the Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. And the heavens and the earth tremble, but the Lord is a refuge for his people and a stronghold to the sons of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. And Jerusalem will be holy, and strangers will pass through it no more. And also Zechariah 12, and I think we may have just read part of this one as well. One through nine, yeah, we read the first couple of verses, or two and three here. Four, in that day declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with bewilderment and his rider with madness. And I will watch over the house of Judah, while I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Then the clans of Judah will say in their hearts, a strong support for us are the inhabitants of Jerusalem, that through the Lord through the Lord of the armies, their God. In that day I will make the clans of Judah like a fire pot among pieces of wood and a flaming torch among sheaves. So they will consume on the right hand and on the left all the surrounding peoples, while the inhabitants of Jerusalem will again dwell on their own sites in Jerusalem. The Lord will also save the tents of Judah first, in order that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem may not be magnified above Judah. In that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David. Now, if your worst warrior is like David, that's I would take that. And the house of David will be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them, and it will come about in that day, I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And then chapter 14, 1 through 3, behold, a day is coming for the Lord, when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. And I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured and houses plundered, the women ravished, and half the city exiled. But the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. And I gave you here some, you can read these, extra-biblical sources, that this is a part of Jewish literature, not only at the biblical level, but at the extra-biblical level. 1 Enoch 90:19, and I saw till a great sword was given to the sheep, and the sheep proceeded against all the beasts of the field to slay them. Obviously, this is in a metaphorical sense. And all the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven fled before their face. And I saw that man who wrote the book according to the command of the Lord, till he opened that book concerning the destruction of those last 12 shepherds had wrought, and showed that they had destroyed much more than their predecessors before the Lord of the sheep. And I saw till the Lord of the sheep came unto them and took in his hand the staff of his wrath and smote the earth, and the earth was split asunder. And all the beasts and all the birds of heaven fell from among those sheep and were swallowed up by the earth, and it covered them. And you can also read the other ones there, 1 Enoch 94:9-10, and 4 Ezra, which is also called 2 Esdras, in there. So 4D, the war is referred to as the great day of God the Almighty, since this is the time that God will flex his omnipotence and will demonstrate his sovereignty, should be, and bring the world as we know it to an end. And I don't think REM's going to be standing around singing. I'm fairly certain they won't, in fact. But the end of the world as we know it's coming. That is a fact. And as an adjusted believer, I do feel fine. But they aren't going to. They're not going to enjoy it at all. And 41, evil will be dealt with and destroyed. Satan and his demons will be confined, and the world will enter into the blessing aspects of the day of the Lord. As we pointed out, the day of the Lord technically begins at the middle of Daniel's 70th week, but the first 3.5 years of the day of the Lord are devoted completely, pretty much, to destruction. And that is told in so many passages. And then you read the other passages about the blessing aspects of the day of the Lord, and that concerns what we might call the millennium proper, where the Lord has established his rule on the planet and all that. All right, well, let's see. I think I'm just going to stop there. There's no point in doing this verse, and we wouldn't get very far into it anyway, so we'll quit about 10 minutes early. And We will pick up here with verse 6, or 15 rather, on next Sunday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.